One of the ironies of almost any kind of a public health problem, and not just smoking, I think it's a lot of them, is that as you get the problem solved, you now find more money than you can deal with.
Yeah.
Whereas back in the early days, when the problem was the greatest and the need the most, you know, we were dealing with nickels and dimes.
That was Donald Shopland talking about the 1964 Surgeon General's report on smoking and health, which turned 60 this year. This landmark report stated that cigarettes cause lung cancer and other diseases. Shopland was there as an original member of the staff of the Advisory Committee to the Surgeon General. Since 1962, Shopland has served as an editor of 17 reports of the Surgeon General on smoking and health, as interim director in the Office on Smoking and Health for 2 years in the 1980s, and as an advisor on smoking and health at NCI. He retired in 2014. I'm Alex Carolind, and you're listening to the Cancer History Project podcast. In this episode, Shopland speaks with Alan Blum, director of the Center for the Study of Tobacco and Society at the University of Alabama. Blum is serving as guest editor this month as we examine the legacy of the Surgeon General's report.
I have the honor today to be interviewing Don Shopland, someone whom I've known for really quite a few decades and who I admire greatly. He's a former 40-year employee of the Public Health Service and the only one in the world who has worked on 37, I think it is, reports of the Surgeon General of the United States on smoking and health, and is the only one who can now say that he was there when the initial report was produced, because he was on the staff and the youngest member of that staff. Welcome, Don. And your origins are in Maryland, is that correct?
Maryland.
You were a student and an intern at the National Library of Medicine in 1962. And you had an interesting circumstance. And before you answer that question, I wanted to say that Alex asked me to do this interview to share with our audience the origins of one of the landmark documents of the 20th century, the report of the Advisory Committee to the Surgeon General of the United States Public Health Service on smoking and health. And we'll establish that, talk about the origins of the report, talk about its immediate impact, and then what it means today. And I should be clear that I would prefer to call this a commemoration. A celebration would sort of suggest it's everything is happy, because I think this is a more nuanced subject. Let's just leave it right now to commemorate an anniversary and hear some of the behind-the-scenes stories that Don Shopland can share with us.
Well, of course, I sort of fell into the work with the Advisory Committee, as you said. I had just started working for the National Library of Medicine as an entry-level library technician in September of 1962, which was right about the time, I think, that Terry had announced the formation of the committee. And
Dr. Luther Terry, we're talking about?
Correct, Dr. Luther Terry.
And he was the Surgeon General appointed by President John F. Kennedy.
And so I was a fairly, I was just out of high school and had just started working there in September as a GS-3, believe it or not. I think I made all of $55 a week or something like that.
Government service?
Yeah, this was
What that stands for?
The library had just opened up. They had been in a downtown area for a number of years and moved out to this huge, beautiful new facility on the NIH campus. And, of course, that's where the advisory committee staff was located. And it's where the advisory committee actually held almost all of its meetings, except for the first one or two introductory meetings. And initially, I worked in the evenings and overtime when they needed someone to help pull reader requests for the advisory committee, photocopy requests, as they were starting to sift through the data. And then it wasn't until the summer of 1963 that I was then assigned full time to work for the committee. And I didn't find out until later that it actually was done at the request of Dr. Terry himself, which I didn't know it at the time. And so from but August of 63 until the end of the project, I worked full-time on the committee as part of the staff.
In correspondence, you've mentioned the person who did specifically invite you to join. What was her name?
Her name was Mildred Bull. She was a very interesting person. I think she was probably like 5'10 or 5'11. And she was a very important person to the project itself, because I don't know if a lot of people don't know the story, but Peter Hamill, who was the medical coordinator and was the chief architect of the committee and the report, got sick right in the middle of the project and had to leave suddenly on the advice of his doctor. And they asked Dr. Gene Guthrie to come in and take over. And Mildred was the person there, the only real person there who knew what was going on when Dr. Guthrie came in, because there was no transition between Dr. Guthrie and Dr. Hamill. So,
and you mentioned her height, because she was such a presence.
Well, she was a very smart lady. Peter Hamill almost resigned trying to get her a promotion in the middle of everything, because she was only hired as his secretary initially, but she ended up almost being sort of the staff director for the project, because she was just so darn good at what she did. And he finally got her the promotion, but Mildred was the glue that held that project together.
So I know we're teasing the listener with bits and pieces of this background, but just a word about yourself. You were intending, you got this internship. Your career intentions, were they library studies, or were they research, or?
Yeah, I wished I could say that I had this grand design as to what I wanted to be. But at the time that I joined the library, I had two job offers. I just graduated high school that spring, and I had two job offers. One was with the National Library of Medicine, and the other was with the NAS out in Laurel, Maryland, which was a much longer drive. So I opted just to take the library job because it was closer. And that was the only planning that went into it.
And that stands for the National Association for the Advancement of Science?
No, that's it was the NSA, the National Security Administration.
Ah, right.
Yeah, I would have been a spook, I guess.
Right. So we'll now just sort of join you with the committee, and let's take it back really as far back as how we even had to have a committee to decide whether smoking was dangerous to health. So we go back now. How far would you like to go back to 1900? When the early reports on the increase of lung cancer were beginning to be reported, or would you like to go to 1930, when we were beginning to see the early epidemiology coming out of Germany and the United States, one published in the New England Journal in 1928 by Lombard and During, pointing to this association between smoking and lung cancer? Or would you like to go more toward the 40s, when DeBakey and Ochsner had reported their several hundred case studies of lung cancer and smoking?
Well, you can start with almost any of those, and you could make a case for the fact that they were the early studies that sort of jump-started things. But I think if you look back and look at the events that really precipitated the movement in terms of trying to get the Public Health Service to look at this issue, you probably would have to start in the 1950s. And that was when the first case control studies were published very early in the 1950s, and it was those studies that also got some publicity. If you know about some of the articles that were published by the Consumers Union and by the Reader's Digest, those were the things that started getting a lot more publicity for the issue itself. And then, of course, you had Dr. Leroy Burney, who asked the Public Health Service to establish a study group in the I think it was 1956, to take a look at the available evidence, which they did. I think that study group was composed of six individuals. Five of them were from the outside of the Public Health Service, and there was one investigator from the NCI who was that study group. And they looked at 16 different studies, and as you know, concluded that they felt that there was a direct relationship between cigarette smoking and lung cancer. And then Dr. Burney himself issued a statement from that study that said the Public Health Service was on record of saying that cigarette smoking was one of the major factors in lung cancer. Although I think he characterized it at the time, he said that excess cigarette smoking was a factor in lung cancer. And I've never understood where the excess or excessive cigarette adjective came from, because the study group didn't say that.
Oh, well, I recall that, wondering that myself when I first heard him on film saying that of the day. So I want to step back one more time. just to put smoking in its context. I don't think many people realize that if you stop and think about it, tobacco has been used for thousands of years. We know that from archaeological evidence of pipes. They were found in the Arctic or in the tropics. We think that tobacco was first cultivated in the Caribbean because there's an island called Tobago, and there's lots of indications that that's where it began. But through trade routes, tobacco and presumably smoking was all over the world. We don't have the organic remnants, of course, but we do have the pipes and other ceremonial objects that we believe were used. But something changed in the late 19th century, certainly by the 20th century, and that was this thing called lung cancer. And the earliest reports on the dangers of smoking were, as far as I've been able to trace, not just King James I, who called it a custom loathsome to the spirit or whatever, and he issued a counterblast against tobacco when Sir Walter Raleigh and others brought it over from America to England, but really around 1804, when Dr. Benjamin Waterhouse gave his lecture to the students at Harvard about the injurious effects of smoking and the vinous spirits. He was talking about cigar smoking, but he was talking about stomach problems, but I think he was on the right track. But it took another 150 years or more for this committee to be established. And why? Because we were certainly arguing over the instance of lung cancer and smoking. And I just want to read from your and my subject today. It's the remarkable report on smoking and health of the advisory committee. And in the very second paragraph of the foreword, Dr. Terry, who was the Surgeon General, few medical questions have stirred such public interest or created more scientific debate than this tobacco health controversy. The interrelationships of smoking and health undoubtedly are complex. The subject does not lend itself to easy answers. Nevertheless, it has been increasingly apparent that answers must be found. So that was his charge. And we go back a bit in time. You've mentioned the reports of the epidemiologists. The ones that I'm familiar with were Bradford Hill and Sir Richard Dahl in The Lancet around 1950. And the British Medical Journal published some of these. And then we had in this country Ernst Winder, who Evarts Graham was able to apprentice as his Winder was one of his students, and they did this epidemiologic work. Among the groups that they looked at were actually physicians and their instance of lung cancer. And then we had Hammond and Horn working, I believe, for the American Cancer Society first, and then ultimately with the Public Health Service. Is that correct? Those are the major epidemiologic groups?
Yeah, I think there was four studies that were published in 1950 itself.
These were retrospective studies.
These were all what they called retrospective.
As you mentioned, case control.
I think there were all four case control studies.
Right.
And of course, those were the ones that sort of got a little bit of the first publicity. But then, if you remember that in addition to Hammond and Horn, and then you had the British Doctor study was one of the first, what we call the prospective
right
cohort studies. And then in this country, I think the first one that actually started before Hammond and Horn is that the U.S. Veterans study was started.
Oh, was that Levin or is it?
The person that was head of that was Harold Dorn.
Ah.
If I recall correct, and I think their study preceded Hammond and Horn by just a little bit, or it could have been maybe Hammond and Horn was a few months before theirs. They were both initiated at the same time, but they were some of the at the time they were two of the very largest prospective studies on anything, let alone on cigarette smoking. And of course, both of them showed that, along with the British Doctor study, that lung cancer among smokers is about 10 to 15 fold higher than among comparable non-smokers. And those got those studies, when the results of those came out, they did generate a lot of publicity that got into the regular national press.
Wow. And I didn't know that about the veteran study, but also think about that, the funding somehow was available for that in spite of the controversy, in spite of the opposition. And I think that's even more remarkable hearing this.
And the veteran study was really important because, as I said, it was one of the really largest studies around at the time until Hammond did his 1 million person study at the end of the decade.
Wow. The other, a couple of, just to dot a couple of I's, Raymond Pearl, at Johns Hopkins in the 1930s, was looking epidemiologically at smoking and found what he believed was conclusive results of the causation. Well, certainly the association between cigarette smoking and lung cancer. And it was George Seldes, who has been considered the greatest journalist of the 20th century, who almost single-handedly got this out into the public, because the traditional media, the major newspapers of the day and the radio stations, were all beholden to cigarette advertisers, and they were not about to bite the hand that fed them.
Yeah. Well, and I think, if I'm not mistaken, I think the Pearl study was one of the first ones that actually showed that there was an effect on overall mortality, not just lung cancer, but I think the Pearl study looked at overall mortality.
Wow. I guess the other thing about this, while we're doing this kind of warm-up to getting to the report, is that it didn't come out of the blue. There had been discussions and debates over the decades. I mean, I don't know when the term cancer sticks was coined, but we were talking about smoking and cancer even before Dr. Alton Ochsner became the most outspoken critic of smoking in the late 1930s. So just briefly, I had the privilege of meeting Dr. Ochsner and giving grand rounds at his hospital. And at 84, he never took an elevator. We climbed up and down the stairs all day long. He was a student at Washington University in St. Louis in 1919, when his pathology professor, George Dock, called him down to the morgue and said, "Take a look at this case. It's called lung cancer. I don't think you're ever going to see another case like it." Yeah. And he found himself 15 years later as a thoracic surgeon, pulling out lungs almost every week of patients with lung cancer. And he made the deduction that most of these individuals were veterans of World War I who had started smoking in World War I, thanks largely to free cigarettes given by the Red Cross and medical societies and ladies' auxiliaries. And again, most were men, had started in World War I, were veterans. And there was this lag time of 15 years. And he was the one who drew this deduction. And with Dr. DeBakey and others, published their first, I think, 400 cases in the Journal of the American Medical Association by 1939. But really, it led up to the industry reacting to every one of these things by saying, we need more research, and you're not telling the whole story, and on, to the point where the medical community, two-thirds of whom smoked, in the 19, including my father, just not buying into this association. So we had then, as you mentioned, Dr. Burney, the Surgeon General. We might want to define what the Surgeon General's office is and what your understanding was at the time that you began working for Dr. Terry.
Well, at the time that I joined the Public Health Service, the Surgeon General was essentially the head of the entire Public Health Service. So they were over all the different institutes of NIH, they were over CDC, they were over the FDA, and the Office of the Surgeon General was the management arm of the Public Health Service in terms of managing and administrating the entire health component of PHS.
A very big deal, which was probably why Dr. Terry, who was the Surgeon General under whom you worked, deferred very, very favorably to Dr. Burney. In his own article that he wrote when I was editor of the New York State Journal of Medicine, he wrote what he called the behind-the-scenes account of this, and he credited Dr. Burney for the statement that Dr. Burney had issued in 1957 and the formation of that committee.
As you know, Dr. Burney issued another statement, a much lengthier statement, in JAMA,
yes,
in November, I forget the date, in November of 1959, in which he reviewed additional data from a newer study that had come out since the study group was formed. And it was a very lengthy article. And the thing about that article is that he no sooner issued that article than the editor-in-chief of JAMA castigated Burney over taking such a strong stand, and essentially told Burney that he had better things to do than to attack cigarette smoking. And he did that in a published editorial.
Well, it was in the same issue, and both of these are going to be on our exhibition about the Surgeon General's report. We're updating what I did 10 years ago when you were our what really one of our main speakers at the 50th commemoration here at the University of Alabama at Gorgas Library. Dr. Burney himself wrote the disappointment that he had by the AMA not taking a position in the 1950s on smoking was compounded by a highly critical editorial by the editor of JAMA, John Talbot.
Yeah.
By the way, again, just an aside, I met Dr. Talbot in Miami when I was a resident. I had lunch with him because I wanted to meet all the other editors of JAMA. He was a rheumatologist by training, so I don't know how he could weigh in on smoking, but he did. And one never questions the freedom of an editor, Dr. Burney wrote, to express his views, but in the absence of any official AMA position on the hazards of cigarette smoking and lung cancer, an editorial by the editor in the official publication of the organization could very well lead the medical profession, the public, and the media to assume that the editor was in fact expressing the unspoken position of the AMA.
Well, and the offshoot of that, you know, of course, the AMA is and still back then and is still now a very powerful health organization when you think about it's you know, hundreds of thousands of membership. And if you look back at that point in time, there were some people that were pushing the Public Health Service to do something education-wise about smoking. And one of the main reasons that they didn't do it was because of Talbert's editorial that all of the newspapers picked up. If you go online and look at the tobacco documents, you can find pages and pages of newspaper clippings in response to that letter to the editor that Talbert wrote, and all of them pointed out that Talbert and the AMA said that Burney ought to just mind his own business.
Well, by the way, we might want to give a reference to when you said the tobacco industry documents. It's very easily accessible. They are upwards now, I think, of 80 million documents learned in discovery in litigation in the 1990s. They've been supplemented and they've been digitized. What's the website? Is it?
I think if you do a search and just say tobacco documents, it will show up.
That's right. And this was initially worked on by UCSF in California, and now it's quite a repository. Yeah. I think, frankly, just to put in a plug, the our website here at the Center for the Study of Tobacco and Society is the perfect complement, because I don't have as many internal tobacco documents. But we were the first, actually, back when Eric Solberg was running our group in Baylor in Houston, Eric was the first person to organize tobacco industry documents that we had obtained through some way. I was entrusted with quite a few boxes of these, and Eric thought to organize them, and we let them go to the FDA, and Dr. Kessler was able to use these in his first attempt to regulate nicotine products in the 1990s. That having been said, these documents today are fascinating. Our center supplements it with the original material that the industry said out loud in public that few other people have saved. So just to step back again to the 1950s, we both look at this as a lost opportunity to act on Hammond and Horn, Hill and Dahl, Graham and Winder, and to really take action. They did not do that. But then you have the American Cancer Society, the American Heart Association, the National Tuberculosis Association, which was the forerunner of the American Lung Association. In your chronology, you noted that they sent a letter to the newly elected president, John F. Kennedy, requesting an advisory committee be established to determine once and for all whether Dr. Burney's statement is what we should have as the official national position. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. They wrote a letter, I think it was dated June the 1st of 1961, asking him to appoint a commission to look at the entire issue of smoking and health. And it's my understanding that that letter went from the White House over to then what was called DHEW, Health Education and Welfare, and that an undersecretary in that office essentially drafted a reply that said that the appointment of a new commission or a committee by President Kennedy would be inconsistent with his campaign promise to eliminate a number of commissions and committees. And so that was the response that went back to Ms. Sheehan, who was the president of the APHA at the time, that essentially said that the president doesn't think this was would be a good thing to do, essentially, because he's trying to abolish these commissions and not have more appointed. And from there, the issue sat for a number of months until the voluntary health organizations contacted Secretary Ribicoff at the time and asked that something be done. And I believe at that time they had tried to contact Terry, and Terry had recommended to the secretary that a committee be established. But he said, if you did this, you need to check with the White House because there are certain things you need to be aware of politically. But it's my impression that the secretary's office sat on that request and it never got forwarded to the White House. So after two attempts, nothing really happened. And then, of course, you know the story about the Kennedy being asked that at his press conference.
Well, there's two other things that
we... That's right. There was one more. I recall correctly, I think Terry himself at one time, when it was right after the Royal College of Physicians report came out, and Terry drafted a very lengthy memo to now Secretary Celebrezze at HEW, in which he listed seven reasons as to why this issue needs to be looked at again, one of which was new information, obviously. Another was the fact that there had been some legislation introduced in the Congress. And, of course, the Royal College of Physicians had just issued a report in which it said that there was a relationship not only with lung cancer, but with heart and probably bronchitis and emphysema as well. And so he listed those seven reasons as to why a new look at this should be undertaken. But again, that request sat in Celebrezze's office and never went forward.
Which is interesting for a couple of reasons. First of all, Dr. Birney, who was the Surgeon General in the 1950s under Dwight David Eisenhower, actually credits his Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare, Marion B. Folsom, who had been an official of the Eastman Kodak Company, who gave him carte blanche, which I think is really interesting. You think of the Democrat progressive Kennedy being more open, but it was Eisenhower's administration that actually was more open to talking about. Now, perhaps Eisenhower, who spoke very heavily and had a well-known myocardial had infarction, might have been more interested in this than Kennedy was. But certainly, we don't get any sense that John Kennedy or Celebrezze had any interest in this issue, and were more interested in the politics. And just to step back, I forgot to mention the 300 years of American politics during which tobacco became, if not the number one income producer for taxes, among the very top income boosters in the whole United States. This was an economic pillar of society. We couldn't deny that tobacco employed however many hundreds of thousands of people and was a mainstay of the economy of numerous states. So we're not going to just sweep that under the rug. And then we got into the issue of personal freedoms and so forth. But it was clearly not the initial part of the Kennedy administration that was interested in this, even after the Royal College of Physicians report that you mentioned came out in 1962. And that has its own story that we could go into at some point, but that's the copy. This was really the result of just two people. It was Sir George Godber, who was the one of the architects of the National Health System, National Health Service in England, and who was the chief medical officer, probably the equivalent of the Surgeon General. And he was very upset to be walking in the halls of Parliament and seeing everybody smoking in spite of all the epidemiologic evidence that was coming out. And he decided that the government just wasn't going to do anything. So he approached his friend Charles Fletcher of the Royal College of Physicians and said, let's have lunch. And they thought of maybe they could buy some ads and put up some billboards, or they thought, but they came upon Fletcher said, well, why don't we, the college issue a report? And he was the guy that pretty much wrote it single-handedly. Yeah, yeah. And that report had an immediate impact in England. And it was a month later that, or 2 months later, that Kennedy had that press conference. And Edgar Prinner, the reporter for the Washington Evening Star, had seen the report and posed the question that Kennedy wasn't expecting to hear. Well, there's this report in England that says they're going to start doing a lot on smoking. What about our administration?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Kennedy tried to fob it off and say, well, I don't want to talk about it because the stock market is open today. I'll get back to you. And what he did do was pretty much having to let that committee go forward. And that's how, that's where you come in, and that's where this committee comes in. So let's just mention, what about this committee? How did it get formed, and where did it meet, and what were the criteria for a committee member?
Well, it was interesting, and this is, you could probably say maybe it was the brilliance of Luther Terry. When he had gotten the approval from both the secretary and the White House, because both of them had to give him the go-ahead, he decided to hold the best thing, a way you could call it, would be a planning meeting, and in which he invited all of the, quote, interested parties who had a stake in the game to this meeting to draw up the parameters of the study, as well as the criteria for who would be included in terms of on this committee. And of course, that meant that you had not only the players in the Public Health Service and the Federal Trade Commission and the FDA, all the voluntaries, the AMA, but it also included the tobacco industry. And so at that meeting, you actually had two representatives from the tobacco industry. One was George Allen, who was president of the Tobacco Institute, and the other was Clarence Cook Little, who was the director of the Tobacco Industry Research Committee,
that's correct.
That later morphed into the Council for Tobacco Research. But they were part of that planning. And so they were part of the group that actually drew up the criteria in terms of what the study would be. And that's where they came up with the idea that there would be two phases. One would be the first phase that would look at the magnitude and the nature of the health threat. And then the phase two study would be if they find that smoking was a health hazard, what would you now do about it? And that was what phase two was supposed to be about. And that group also drew up the criteria. They said that they did not want anybody who really knew anything about the issue, so that they were taking a stand on the issue, which pretty much eliminated anybody who had done any work, any type of research on the issue, because obviously that would have meant they had to take a stand, you know. And they also could not be part of any particular organization, was the other criteria, nor could they have had any kind of a public statement either for or against smoking and health. And so from that, it pretty much meant that any committee members that you were going to consider would have to be, quote, virgins in a sense. They had to be people who didn't really know anything about the issue. And so that group of, I think it was about a dozen different organizations represented around the table. They drew up an initial list of 155 individuals. And it was from that list that the committee, the eventual 10 committee members were chosen. But the unique thing about that process is that anybody could eliminate an individual to serve on the committee or from that list for any reason whatsoever. In fact, they didn't have to even give a reason. So they had complete veto power. And so it's remarkable that out of that list of 155 people, we had 10 people that essentially the tobacco industry had approved by virtue of the fact that they did not eliminate any of the individuals that were chosen to serve on the committee. You know, as you know, we have a book coming out about the 64 report that we hope is going to be published in the spring.
The we being?
It was myself and four other people that actually worked on the report. Two were committee members, which were Manny Farber and Mickey LeMaitre, and two of the senior PHS professionals, which was Drs. Guthrie and Dr. Hamill. And so the book will be essentially a collection of us putting together our best narrative that we could in terms of how we actually put that report together. But it also goes into a lot of the events that led up to it, and including the selection and who agreed to serve and who did not agree to serve as well.
Well, I'm doubly appreciative that you've chosen to honor us with talking about that, giving us some little previews of it. But I guess whether it was the first 10 or whatever that they chose, I was struck too, unless you could correct me here, There were obviously no women selected, but I didn't even see in the list of 155, I think it actually totals 188 sources that they cite, that Dr. Terry cites in the acknowledgments. I did not see or recognize any women. There were a few cited, but none were selected for the committee. And was that ever something that you thought of?
I never had a chance to talk to anybody about it. And of course, you're now talking about the early 1960s, and it was a very much of a male-dominated movement, if you will, of society. I'll be interested. I think the original list of 155, which, by the way, five names were eliminated from that. They really actually chose the 10 from a list of 150. And we asked Peter Hamble about who was eliminated, and was any eliminated by the tobacco industry. And he said the tobacco industry never eliminated anybody. So the five that were eliminated were eliminated by somebody else. But I don't recall him talking about anybody other than the 12 or 15 that he contacted and wanted to actually serve. None of those were women either. I'd be interested to know if we went back to the archives and found the original list as to whether there was any women actually listed.
Maybe some weren't listed because maybe more women had spoken out, like Senator Marie Neuberger on smoking. But I'm just hypothesizing. The fact we could talk about her for the whole hour, but she was the first elected official that I'm aware of, the senator from Oregon, to really blast the tobacco industry and call for remedial action and do everything. And her book is, in fact, as long as I brought her up, let me just mention a quote that I found in her introduction. She cites, right after the publication of the Royal College of Physicians report that we were just alluding to, a journalist writing in The Lancet said, "Future historians will have views on our failure to find even a partial solution to the problem of smoking during the first 10 years after its dangers were revealed." Now, I don't know whether they're referring to the dangers having been revealed by, I think, Hill and Dahl in 1950. The enormous and increasing number of deaths from smoker's cancer may go down in history as a strong indictment of our political and economic ways of life. And then she adds, "Yet which segments of our society and which institutions will these future historians indict? The tobacco industry for its callous and myopic pursuit of its own self-interest? The government for its timidity and inertia in failing to formulate a positive program for prophylaxis? The medical profession for abdicating its role of leader in this crucial area of public health? Or is the individual, smoker and non-smoker alike, incriminated by his failure to accept responsibility for his own and his society's well-being?" She said that she thinks all of those folks are going to be blamed. I think she was very
perfect. You can check all of those boxes, I think.
Yeah, I mean, that's 1962 that she said this, and I think we make almost the same statement today. But just to go back to that selection, we had these people. They all agreed to meet, and there were some extraordinary backgrounds. Chairman of pathology, an epidemiologist, biostatistics experts. They certainly got a great, well-rounded group.
If you know who Peter Hamill is, he did a series of interviews for the JF Kennedy Oral History Project that he did in 1969 and 1970, which isn't too many years after the report came out. And you can get these off their website, by the way. He goes into a lot of, he was the one that Terry charged with actually selecting and vetting the committee members. And he was a very young guy at the time. He was only 36 years old when he was tapped to actually serve as the medical coordinator to the committee. But he was the one that vetted all those guys. And in his interviews, he goes into a very lengthy discussion of who he was looking for, the types of talents, the disciplines he was looking for, what type of people they were, what kind of thinkers they were. As I said in part of the introduction I wrote for our book, he was really, if we were looking at this today, we would say he was looking for people who thought outside the box.
Wow.
And it really was. He wanted people who weren't afraid to mix it up in an argument. And even though they were going to be arguing about data or at least studies that they didn't really have a lot of familiarity with, but he knew that these were people that could do a good job of, quote, educating themselves during the process and be willing to actually take on a debate in this committee if they felt strongly about certain issues. And that was the type of people he was looking for. He wanted people who weren't afraid to speak up.
My understanding is that he was, again, another boy wonder. He, at 29, was, well, he was a physician. He graduated medical school and then got an MPH and was offered, I believe, a chairmanship and turned it down, went to Emory to establish a preventive medicine department, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I don't know about his earlier history. At the time that he was chosen to be the medical coordinator, he was the chief epidemiologist for the Division of Air Pollution Control at PHS. This would have been the precursor that eventually morphed and probably into the EPA but into the 70s.
Wow.
But he was so he was an epidemiologist by training as well. He was also a former Golden Gloves boxing champion.
That's right. That's right.
You know, and in the book I cite him as being brilliant, intense, and he was really what I would call a Renaissance man. He was very highly educated, a very rounded education, and this comes through in his interviews with the Kennedy School. And he was probably a pretty smart cookie.
Well, let's now that we've done speaking of boxing, the preliminary rounds, let's get to the main bout. And the main bout would be, I guess you'd start it with that first meeting of the committee and how they set their course, and then that unexpected blow that they received fairly early on that led them to react and to be even more independent.
Well, people lose sight of the fact when the committee was first established, Luther Terry and them thought that this could be done in 6 or 7 months, because that's the way that most other committees had worked on this kind of an issue, and they could do a report in, you know, 5, 6, 7 months. But here you had a group of 10 guys that didn't know anything about the issues. They weren't familiar with the data. They weren't experts. And here they had sort of dumped in their lap 7,000 studies that they now got to sift through. And these guys, you know, didn't know what to do with it. They actually spent the first two meetings trying to figure out what they were going to do. So the November meeting and the January meeting is where they really started to try to grapple with how they were going to structure themselves, but more importantly, what type of methodology were they going to adopt in order to be able to issue a report that would essentially stop the controversy, or that was going to end the controversy as to whether smoking was a health risk. And a lot of these guys, as you know, were cigarette smokers. And so they came with a certain amount of bias in some cases. And like anybody else that was around at that time, if you were a smoker, you didn't want to believe this stuff. And they weren't any different than the general public was. But it took them a good 2 months or two committee meetings before they actually got deep enough into some of the discussions about some of the data before they themselves decided that if they were going to answer this question, they were going to have to go a lot deeper than what the public health services expect them to do, and come up with something a lot more detailed than something like the Royal College of Physicians.
Let's not forget, just to step back a little bit, even to the 50s and even back to the 40s, you know, there was a hearing of the Federal Trade Commission in the early 1940s about the outlandish health claims of cigarette advertising. But of course, just like all these appeals we hear about of certain figures being about to be criminally charged, they kept delaying and delaying, even though the FTC said you can't say that more doctors smoke Camels. It took them 10 years to correct it. So you have the leading advertiser on radio and in newspapers, literally the leading advertiser, blocking any real convincing evidence, because they'd always say there's another side. They would always give the other side. And Bernie himself writes that he gave the tobacco industry the courtesy a couple of days before he issued his first statement, saying there's sufficient evidence to support the claim that there is a causal link between smoking and lung cancer. they immediately released at the same time as his statement. That's how they repaid his kindness, with a blistering attack on it. And so he said that you should never trust that industry in any way, shape, or form. So we come to this pass where I think this committee was aware of that. And then you point out in our earlier correspondence that one day they came into their meeting and they were told they better get it done quickly.
That's correct. That happened at the May meeting.
Which is about the third or fourth?
That would have been the fourth meeting. And this is
they were meeting at the National Library of Medicine.
Correct. James Hunley, who was the Assistant Surgeon General and chaired all the meetings of the advisory committee, or he either chaired or co-chaired, he essentially came in, went into an executive session and said that essentially you all got to get the report out and get the report out now. And he sort of gave them two options. You can either finish up where you are right now and issue the report, or you can let the PHS take it over and let them finish up the report for you. And of course, the committee went ballistic, because just the meeting before in March, Hunley himself had drawn up a timeline for the report and had said, it looks like given where we are, that probably the best we can probably do is have a report issued by the end of the year. And the committee agreed with it. They thought that was a logical timeline and one that they would then work toward. And now here the next meeting, he's saying you've got to finish up the report and finish it up now.
And the committee was so angry, they literally told him to leave the room while they decided?
They essentially threw him out of the room and they went into their own executive session and tried to make sense about what they thought was going on. They bantered back and forth about what they thought was the push behind all of this. They had pushed Hunley to find out whether Dr. Terry knew about it. Was he behind it? They wanted to speak to Dr. Terry, and Hunley essentially said that he wasn't available and was noncommittal about whether Terry knew anything. And so they brought back Hunley. They brought Hunley back in another discussion about what was going on and pressed him some more. Hunley still really wasn't giving up any information. They asked him to leave again. And at that point in time, they decided that they were going to take over the report. The report was going to be theirs and theirs alone. They decided that there would be no minority report on any issue, that everything that they would agree upon would be unanimous, and which probably came back to haunt them in some cases, which we can discuss a little bit later on. And they essentially called Hunley back in and said, we're going to do it our way. You all won't be able to see the report. We will issue the report directly to the public. Neither you nor Dr. Terry, nor the department, nor the White House will be allowed to see this report until it's made public.
Yes, and it's just every time I hear the story, I learn something new. In case we don't get to it, because we'll wrap it up not that long from now, is the one of the regrets is that they really didn't tackle addiction.
Well, I think they tried to tackle addiction, and let's keep also something in mind as well. These guys weren't addiction experts by any stretch of the imagination. But having talked to, I know Mickey at some length about this.
Mickey LeMaitre, who was the youngest member of the committee.
Who was the youngest member, and Len Schumann years ago. Len was the only epidemiologist on the committee, by the way, at least what
the
I
University call, of Minnesota.
A card-carrying epidemiologist. And they admitted that they really pushed the issue and really wanted to declare smoking addictive. Sievers was the person that pretty much held everything up, and he had been on the WHO committee that had established a lot of the WHO criteria for different substances, including nicotine, and they held at that time that it was not addictive, but it was habitual. And that's what he fell back on it, and that's what he said the committee had to go to. That was the only criteria that they had at that time, was to use the WHO criteria, and they held that it was habituating and not addictive. But from my understanding is that either all of the committee or most of the committee wanted to label it addictive, But again, this is where Sievers was the person who really knew the most about it, and he relied too much on the WHO criteria. Plus, they knew they didn't want to do a minority report.
He was the chair of pharmacology at the University of Michigan.
Correct.
His field was listed as pharmacology of anesthesia and habit-forming drugs. I'll just quickly review. Dr. Schumann was professor of epidemiology at the University of Minnesota, and his field was health and its relationship to the total environment. LeMaitre was a professor of internal medicine at the University of Texas Southwest Medical School, and his specialty was internal medicine and pulmonary diseases and preventive medicine. John Hickam, an internist, was a specialist in physiology of cardiopulmonary disease. Jacob Firth, professor of pathology at Columbia, was an expert in cancer biology. Louis Pfizer, professor of organic chemistry at Harvard, was an expert in the chemistry of carcinogenic hydrocarbons. Manny Farber was chairman of the Department of Pathology at the University of Pittsburgh, an expert in experimental and clinical pathology. William Cochran, professor of statistics at Harvard, with special application to biological problems. And two more, Walter Burdett, who is head of surgery at the University of Utah, was a geneticist and also a clinical experimental surgeon. Lastly, Dr. Bain Jones, Stanhope Bain Jones, the eldest member of the committee, retired at that time, and a past president of the Society of American Bacteriologists, was an expert in the nature and causation of disease in human populations.
Correct.
So they proceeded. They had a remarkable work by the staff of getting these articles. You were pulling articles. They were evaluating. You said they're total about 7,000. And they divided up the various chapters among the committee members. And you said all was proceeding pretty well except for one.
Well, the cancer chapter.
The most important.
Of all things. When they sort of decided as to how they were going to divvy this up during the January meeting, it was between the November and January meetings, Burdett had agreed to take on the cancer chapter, which was logical. I mean, he had a background in it. He was a very well-known thoracic surgeon. And from what everybody talked about Burdett is that he not only was brilliant, but everything he touched, he tended to be able to be a real go-getter and could take on anything and get anything done. He was supposed to be, you know, if you had a room full of people, he would be declared the smartest guy in the room, so to speak. But he also was a geneticist. In fact, he had written several books about genetics, and had a degree in genetics. And a lot of the cancer chapter, as he was approaching it, unfortunately put too much emphasis on genetic and constitutional factors as related to cancer etiology, particularly lung cancer etiology. And it was a very slow, I think the way that Mickey LeMaitre described it is that it was almost like pulling teeth, trying to get Burdett to put more emphasis on the epidemiology of cigarette smoking and cancer at different sites, and less emphasis on the genetic aspect of it. And by the time the summer was, late summer was coming on, the cancer chapter was still in pretty much disarray. A lot of stuff was there. You know, I'd say the bones, the way they described the bones of the chapter was there, but they really were dissatisfied with how the chapter was shaping up. And about this time, it was when Hamill was getting sick and was starting to take more and more treatments for it. He had a very painful neck condition. And it was about that time that his physician said that he had to give up work immediately. And what Hamill did is that he privately contacted Len Schumann and asked Len Schumann if he would take on the task of trying to incorporate the data from all the epidemiologic studies on lung and other cancers. Schumann agreed to do it. In fact, what Schumann did is he took 30 days leave from his post at the University of Minnesota and spent it at committee headquarters from the middle of August until the middle of September, completely rewriting a lot of the chapter, emphasizing the epidemiology of lung cancer as it related to cigarette smoking. And believe it or not, it was something that the other committee members knew nothing about. When we were writing the book, John Harkness at the University of Minnesota pointed out to him all the yeoman work that Schumann had done, and Mickey didn't know about it. So I spent a full day up at the University of Minnesota going through the archives collection up there of Schumann, and found all kinds of documentation for it, including his 30-day stay at the local hotel in Bethesda. And the fact that I do remember very distinctly, because I bet the same time that I went to work for the committee, Len Schumann was there quite a bit. And I didn't know who he was at the time, because, you know, as a 18-year-old kid, what did I know? And I told Mickey that. And so it all kind of dovetailed the fact that he actually spent a good part of his summer writing the cancer chapter, that if he had not done that, you know, the report probably would have been delayed by at least a couple of months.
I heard he used his vacation time
He used his 30-day vacation time from the university and spent it at the headquarters in the basement of the National Library of Medicine, rewriting that chapter.
Well, let's just advance it forward to November 22nd, 1963.
Yeah, it was a very sad day. The committee was coming in for a meeting that very weekend. Keep in mind, because these guys all had academic positions back at their home base, when they came in to meet as a committee, the meetings were always on the weekend, so that they could continue doing their normal work. So they would come in on a Friday and would spend Friday, Saturday, sometimes Sunday, sometimes Monday, depending on the workload. And that particular weekend, they were supposed to meet. And as it happened, of course, Kennedy was assassinated in Dallas. And believe it or not, Mickey LeMaitre was called into Park Lawn Hospital to work on John Conley with one of his colleagues, who was actually called over. And he took Mickey with him. And we actually had to contact Jacqueline Kennedy's office, her secretary, to find out if we should even meet that weekend, given the circumstances. And we got to go ahead and to work that weekend, even though it was a very, you talk about a somber meeting.
That was, yeah, you were nearing the very end of the report.
Well, we were at the point to where they were writing the conclusions now, and writing a lot of the judgments that they were going to then make in terms of the different relationships, in anticipation that they may or may not meet one more time, which they eventually did. But that meeting went through Monday and I think into Tuesday because of the circumstances. And ironically, that night, that Friday night, the night of his assassination, the National Library of Medicine is right across the street from the National Navy Medical Center. And we were there when they brought Kennedy's body in for doing an autopsy. Hmm. It was right across the street from us. So we were sort of on the tail end of that history when they brought his body in to be autopsied that weekend.
Yeah, history almost changed regarding the report, because there was some question with the new president whether this report would be released. And one of the suspicions was that because President Johnson's close advisor had been a lobbyist, well, had been the lawyer for the main tobacco organizations, that there might this report might be deep sixed.
Well, I don't know of any effort that was made by anybody, either at the department level or the White House, to stop the report. If it happened, I was never aware of it. The person who would have known that would have been Gene Guthrie, who at that time now had taken over for Hamill and was the medical director of the report and was essentially in charge of it. He has never mentioned that, and I've known Gene for a number of years. I knew him well after the report came out. He and I met several times and talked about the report and what went on. He never mentioned anybody interfering with the thing. So I don't know that has any credibility, that someone actually, like Fortas or anybody else,
I'll keep, you mentioned Fortas being Abe Fortas, who became the Supreme Court judge under Johnson and then resigned because of fairly minor things compared to what we see today. But in any event, Dr. Lemaitre did share with me, and I'm going to try to track it down, that he spoke to Johnson, whether he spoke to him just in passing or since they were both Texans, to encourage him to let this report go forward. I got the sense that Dr. Lemaitre felt that Abe Fortas was going to lobby against releasing that report. But I'll follow up with you.
You'll have to, because I remember talking to Mickey at one point, and I'll have to say I don't recall what the genesis of the conversation was. I remember him saying that he had met Johnson in his office at one point, and Abe Fortas was there.
Well, we agree on that at least.
And it was my impression this was after the report was released, in which Mickey had, quote, you know, almost like volunteered his time to Johnson to talk about implementation of something in terms of any kind of anti-smoking activity. And it was at that point that Mickey told me that he turned to Abe Fortas and said that Abe Fortas was going to be his guy on that or something to that effect. But it was my impression that was after the report was released.
Well, I'll keep searching for that holy grail. But I think that what we're doing now, as we begin to wind down, we're talking about the moment of the release, but then the aftermath. One thing we do know for sure that Lyndon Johnson never endorsed the report. He permitted it to go through, and I went to the LBJ Library where we had our exhibition. That you saw 10 years ago, we had it also, they had it at the LBJ Library. So I asked to go up to the one day I spent up in the library part, and I asked them if they could produce their archive on anything to do with smoking under Johnson. And they gave me two little boxes with a bunch of letters from the public, and there was literally nothing else. Yeah. I kept saying, no, I would like maybe some behind the scenes policy thing. No, they had nothing. So he was not, as far as I know, ever, even when he had his illnesses, Johnson smoked, but I don't think it ever really came up. He was not a strong endorser of that report. I haven't had a chance to ask Califano, who worked in the Johnson administration, whether there was anything else, but just seems to me that Johnson did his good deed by letting it go forward.
Name me one president that I would say was a big supporter of the smoking control movement.
That's right.
And I don't know of any.
This gets into the last really point of it. What people will see on the website will be some of the videotape of the film of when Dr. Terry released it. We have some documentaries that were done by CBS and NBC that I got a hold of, and that's going to be shown. I think the Harry Reasoner documentary on smoking and health issued that March, 2 months after the report, is one of the best documentaries I've ever seen. He literally interviews the tobacco industry, the man in the street, school kids, some members of the report. It's riveting. And he interviews the advertising agencies and David Ogilvie, who was the first ad agency to decline cigarette advertising. But in any event, your opinion then of the impact of the report immediately and then long term, because you are the only one who was there from the outset to fully, till 2014, working on virtually every report of the Surgeon General's. Did these subsequent reports that came out, did they have a major role compared to the initial report, or were they there to just reinforce it?
It's hard to say, there were probably a few reports in the series that probably had an immediate impact. I think the major impact of these reports is in their totality, in terms of documenting the health risks that then permitted, other people especially to do something about it. People like yourself, the voluntaries. Certainly once that you got into the nicotine stuff and the FDA got more involved, but that was like 30 years later, you could make some judgment that the report on nicotine addiction maybe pushed that further. But I think the real effect or the real impact of those reports has been what I would call the constant drumbeat of more and more pronouncements that eventually, I think, more than anything else, undermine the behavior. It undermined the social acceptability of smoking. And I think that particularly was true once we started documenting that it had an effect on the non-smoker. But I think all of those, the reports taken in total, eventually just moved the needle forward little bit by little bit. There were no big changes, as you know, from year to year. And I think what we're seeing now, even though it's taken, 60 years, we're now looking at the end result of that. If you go back to, say, before the report, when you had close to 50% of the adult population smoking, now the latest figures that I saw come out of CDC for, I guess it was 2000 or 2022, is showing the adult rate now to 11.2%. So we're almost getting down to single digits.
Right, and even teens, even lower than that. But, you know, I'll give the other side of that in any day, and that is, first of all, it took 60 years to do it. We didn't start seeing a decline in lung cancer rates among men. It's still not declining among women. I think the three reports, if we want to talk about the positive steps forward that I would vote for, I think you and I have corresponded about this. I think the passive smoking Surgeon General's report, the report on addiction, and I would say the report on women. Those were major earth-shaking headlines that did propel changes. The passive smoking led to the ban on smoking on airlines, the first federal effort on clean indoor air that I'm aware of. So there was not much federal legislation passed as a result of the Surgeon General's report until.
I think that just bolsters my point. I think a lot of the sort of successful anti-smoking steps that we've taken have been taken outside of government.
Right.
By the activists or whoever, who were always ahead of the science to begin with, as you know. The science always comes later, and the people out in the hinterland, if you will, are the ones that take the early action because they can.
As you pointed out in the earliest part of this conversation, the AMA, which really was the voice of American medicine and was respected and listened to, they were absent from the room.
They were the only major medical entity in the country that has never endorsed the 64 report.
Well, what happened was they didn't endorse it, but in 1979, after 15 years, they published their AMA Education Research Foundation report saying, you know, that Surgeon General is probably right back in 64.
Yeah, that's Johnny come lately, isn't it?
Right. Let's go back to November 22nd, 1963. A fellow named Roy Ritz, who became chairman of immunology at Mayo, had been JFK's personal physician at the naval base, and he had been lured by the AMA to come to Chicago to head up the AMA's Education Research Foundation. The day that he arrived on the job, I had the privilege of serving on a committee of the FDA with Dr. Ritz. He arrived in Chicago on November 22nd, 1963, to hear two points of news. Number one, that his patient, JFK, had been killed. And the second bad news he heard was that was told to him as good news. It's good news. The AMA just got $5 million to do more research. And he said, $5 million? That was like $50 million today. And he said, really? That's incredible. And he said, who's that from? He said, they said from the tobacco industry. And he practically quit right then and there because he was going to be the director of this. And he smoked, by the way, but that did not influence his. And he said, no, that's not. And they said, okay, you don't have to work with that money. So Ritz didn't last long at the AMA ERF, but he did relate to me his disappointment even back then. And he joked that, yeah, the AMA did once issue a booklet that said if you smoke in bed, that might cause a fire. But for 15 years, from 1964 to 1979, the AMA virtually was silent on this issue because they were taking what it turned out to be $18 million from the tobacco industry to do more research. And as we close, you know, we look at the mantra. I think we're still doing that today. University of Southern California, I heard last week, got $20 million to study nicotine policy in pediatrics. $20 million to study what? More what? in an age where we're not regulating, we're going backwards. We're actually having less regulation these days.
Well, one of the ironies of almost any kind of a public health problem, and not just smoking, I think it's a lot of them, is that as you get the problem solved, you now find more money than you can deal with.
Yeah.
Whereas back in the early days, when the problem was the greatest and the need the most, you know, we were dealing with nickels and dimes.
You got 7,000 studies to study. By 1985, Dr. Koop, the Surgeon General then, who made smoking a bully pulpit issue, and even after he was opposed by all the public health associations before, because he was a supporter, he was in opposition to abortion. But he said, we have now 50,000 studies. And the industry was saying, we need more research. And he said, what more research do we need? We've got 50,000 studies that show proof positive. Well, do you know how many there are today, Don?
There are probably 100,000.
There's 356,000. At least that's what it was in 2021 when I had a piece of the Lancet.
More.
I don't think so. And this is the sad part about our own culpability. We in the health professions really owed it to the public to act and not continue to study. We love studying, but we've got to translate our research sooner than later. And I know that we could probably, and we're going to have this opportunity in person when on January the 11th, we commemorate this report and we have the honor to host you at the University of Alabama. But I just can't thank you enough for taking the time to talk with us. And we've really just scratched the surface, but you are widely respected in your field as someone who's been on the inside, who engages in respectful conversation and debate at every turn. Lord knows we've disagreed on so many things, but you always take the high road.
Thank you for listening to the Cancer History Project podcast, a podcast of oral histories and interviews with the people who have shaped oncology as we know it. Our archives are available online for free at cancerhistoryproject.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at CancerHistProj. The Cancer History Project is a collaborative historical resource operated by the Cancer Letter. This is an ongoing project and would not be possible without the input and materials provided by our editorial board, our contributors, and the support of our sponsors, including Cedars-Sinai, Roswell Park Comprehensive Cancer Center, MD Anderson Cancer Center, and many others. View a full list of our sponsors at cancerhistoryproject.com/sponsors. If your institution would like to participate in the Cancer History Project, email us at admin@cancerhistoryproject.com.